All right, welcome to episode number 25 of our podcast, Up on Foil, where we talk all about foiling. And today, our guest out of Sri Lanka at the moment on vacation, Tom Hartmann. You've probably seen or heard him before on other podcasts on the YouTube. He is tour manager of the GKA Kite World Tour, tour manager of the GWA Wing Foil Association, and director of Cyan Mauritius. And he just created the SFT. Surfoil World Tour. So super excited to talk about that. Is there anything, Tom, that you just want to add that needs to be known about you?
No, I think you summed up the, let's say, the most important things or what I'm busy with and what I'm doing. Of course, there is a lot I can talk about, but that maybe would like even get too much in detail now. But I've been involved in water sports since a very young age. Just to sum that up, I got into water sports mainly, let's say, at a very young age, I got into sailing because my dad was a very fanatic sailor.
And, what did he sail?
But, he was sailing Flying Dutchman and also some bigger yachts. But, when I was about a teenager, 14, 15 years old, I kind of, thought it's a little bit too boring. I wanted something with a bit more action. And I got one day in my mailbox, like in my physical mailbox, not the email box, I found a catalog of a surf shop, of a windsurf shop. And I saw these pictures of Robbie Nash and, you know, windsurfing in Hawaii. And then I was like, well, this is what I want to do, you know. And then I got into windsurfing at around 14 years old. And this was my first, let's say, board sport. And since then, this is my life, I would say. And I dedicated everything to that. I was windsurfing. I was really a fanatic and really, really addicted to this windsurf sport in the 90s. And then got into competing. I was doing this professionally on the world tour myself as an athlete. And the windsurf
in
world
a race,
tour.
In race or in freestyle?
I was in freestyle, you know. I grew up in that age around 2000 when freestyle windsurfing started, and I got fully hooked on this freestyle windsurfing discipline. When suddenly we were able to do all these tricks on lakes, and it didn't need to be in Hawaii or anywhere else. And this really, like, I think, caught a lot of young people into that sport at that time. And then I didn't really. Well, I competed for quite some years, but honestly, I was always like, for me, it was never about really most important to win anything, but really to work on projects. And I always liked to organize events that were a bit different myself. And then I got injured in 2009. I broke my shoulders just before the first competition of the year. And I got asked if I wanted to become a head judge on the windsurf tour. And that's how I switched into the organizational side. And from then on, from 2009, I started to first be a head judge in the windsurf tour and a race director and then a tour manager. I did this for, 11 years. And then I went into the kite tour. I got asked if I want to manage the kite tour and got involved in the GKA in 2017-18. And then, I started that as a tour manager. And then 3 years later, COVID hit. Suddenly all events were gone and nothing was happening really. And in that time, I was in Mauritius at that time. In the meantime, in between these things, I started my business in Mauritius and I kind of moved there into 10 years ago, 2014, 2015, because I felt like I didn't want to be in Austria because it's just not the right place if you're really into water sports. So I moved to Mauritius to start the business there, but that was, you know, besides. And then in 2020, we had COVID humming and we had no more events and I was stuck in Mauritius. The airport was closed and that time really got me into wing foiling. And suddenly, you know, with wing foiling, I was foiling before on SUP, try this and windsurf and kitesurf foil. Kite foiled, but when I got into wing foiling, I was so amazed how quick and easy this sport is to learn. you know, and I think it's one of the best sports to enter any foil discipline because it's really simple to learn this. And
too much because he has some trouble. Sorry.
Yeah,
don't tell him.
I mean,
now.
For go sure, ahead, if you, I think if you have some wind sport background, it helps. I mean, if you kite and windsurf, you definitely have it helps. But it is, I think, wing foiling is compared to other disciplines, fairly easy entry into a foil sport, and you don't need to have a lot of knowledge before. So when I realized how easy it is, you know, it amazed me how quick the learning curve in wing foil, how steep the learning curve in wing foiling was. I couldn't believe that. I've never done a sport before that has such a steep learning curve. I was thinking, wow, I mean, if I feel this way about this sport, there's plenty of other people who are going to feel the same. And I said to my partner from the GKA, to Jürgen, who's the CEO, I said, well, I think we should, you know, like we should do something with that. And also we had some push from industry. So we started at GWA in 2020 and did the first event in Brazil. In 2020, everybody told us, you guys are crazy. You know, we came up with a concept and there was an organizer in Brazil who said, yeah, I want to do this foil event. So we did this wing foil event and everybody said, you guys are completely nuts. You're going to Brazil. Everybody's dying. It's the worst place about COVID where you can go. I said, well, we do it anyways. And we invited, you know, some of the pioneers of wing foiling at the time, like Balz Müller, like Tito Angalea, let's say around 15, 20 people joined this event that were the pioneers of wing foiling at that time. And all of them came from different backgrounds, be it kiting, be it windsurfing, be it surf foiling, be it SUP. And we did this event. And right after that event, we got so many requests like organizers calling up and said, hey, we want to do something like that. That the year after, we already had a full tour with 5 or 6 events in 2021 with the Wingfoil World Tour. So yeah, we kept running the kite tour, the Wingfoil World Tour. Wasn't easy, obviously, with the COVID years, you know, but now, like since 2 years, we have a decent amount of events back. And then what happened was that we were running in the Wingfoil World Tour. We were running, you know, sometimes kind of a no-win show events, like surf foil events and pump foil events with the guys that were there. We did that in Switzerland, surf foiling in Morocco, Brazil, Cape Verde. That there was also push from the industry saying, hey, you guys should do more of these non-wind-powered, you know, foil discipline events. And we didn't want to run that under the GWA because we thought, you know, we don't want to put those sports into the shadow of the wing foil world tour. No. If we do that, we want to put that on his own feet. And that's how, yeah, the whole idea happened to found the SFT last year. So we worked at that project. And we said, okay, these are all really niche foil disciplines, surf foiling, pump foiling, downwind SUP foiling, wake foiling, e-foiling. So we want to create a platform where all these non-wind-powered foil disciplines get covered. But we want to put them all together for the reason that a lot of events, you can easily combine these disciplines. You have a lot of athletes that actually do multiple of those disciplines. And it will create more attention for the whole platform and the foil sport in general than just having maybe only pump foil tour or only surf foil tour. So that's how, yeah, we created the SFT and we have run the first event where you have been part of in Germany, which was indoors, which was already quite special to do this in the pool on an indoor location. And we are now in, actually the next event is happening in 2 weeks already in the US. And we got a lot of contacts at the moment with organizers who actually want to join, you know, and have events that are already running or want to create new events where these kind of disciplines, let's say the beauty of these SFT foil disciplines that are not wind dependent is that you don't need to have such a long weather window. You know, if we run a kite surf or a wing foil event, we need at least 5-6 days just to be sure we get the conditions, we get the wind to run the competition. But if you run
until then, you're not sure if that will happen, right?
And even then, you're not sure that it's happening. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but it has happened occasionally that you don't get a result. But with this foil, like a pump foil event or an e-foil event or a wake foil event, it's no weather dependent at all. You do this event 1 or 2 days and you get your result and you know, you want to do a final at 3 in the afternoon, you do it at 3 in the afternoon. So you can predict everything much better, which is quite luxury, let's say, in terms of the logistics that we were facing usually with kitesurfing and wing foiling. But yeah, that's where we are standing now. And we want to build this platform. And the first event, I think, has been great. And it's great to also have a new bunch of people that are, again, you know, I see this a bit like wing foiling 5 years ago, that are so fired up about these sports and that are so passionate and they really want to push it. It's not about the money. It's not about, you know, like becoming the world champion right away, but just to be there and, yeah, give your input and support and contribute to the growth of these sports. And I can see that now in all these new foil disciplines happening, what we saw in other sports before. And it's a great time. It's the right time to actually get that going, because I think foiling also is the future in water sports in general. If you see now, hydrofoils are used for motorboats, for sailboats, for surfboards, anything with an engine, with a wind, or with just powered by your legs or by a wave is now getting on foils. And I see a bright future for all these sports.
That is really cool. Now, we had a super long story, your life transitioning into your life in that water sports, in that foil sports. And obviously that's intertwined. You're so much in that scene that it's your life, basically. But let's just go a little bit back. When you was a athlete yourself, the transition into organizing was pretty smooth, as you were already part of that. Was there any time where you thought that, well, this is still it's not a regular job as usually people from Austria, Switzerland have, but it's special. Was that ever something that you thought about, or were you like just going with the wind and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been my full-time thing since the beginning, you know. When I got into organizing my first events, this was more of a part-time project where I was still competing at that time. So I had some sponsors. I was like living out of the sport, let's say, of different projects coming out of the sport. But for sure, it was at that time for me not a full-time job. And I wasn't sure if 10 years later or 15 years later now, I would still be doing that. You know, probably I would have not imagined when I was 20 or 25 that I'm doing what I do now. At that age, I'm still
involved. So what did you do beside that?
Yeah, no, I was, as I said, I mean, I studied as well. So I went to university when I started studying with like 20 years old. But I mean, I started economics and international business management. And I probably now need 10% of what I've learned in university. But what I, the freedom it gave me, I would say, you know, being studying and being able to have enough time to work on other ideas, that was, I think, what got me to what I'm doing now. And I think as long as you're passionate about something, and what I like about a lot of people that do this kind of sports, like yourself too, you are proactive, you know, in developing it and in creating projects, be it, you know, I mean, I got in these sports long before social media, podcasts, YouTube, or anything was existing. So, you know, when I was competing myself, and in the beginning when I organized events, there were, it was very different, and it was way more simple to run events. You know, it was you didn't have a live score systems, you didn't have live streams, you didn't have there was a result. And maybe a month after the event in a magazine, you would read about who was the winner. But it's not like it wasn't, communication was not as fast as it is now, that people 2 minutes after a heat has finished want to see the result online. You know, nowadays, it's a completely different game. And it got a lot more complex. So at that time, it was also less money needed, I think, to run this event, because it was not as complex. And I was not, to answer your question, no, I was not in the beginning. I was always working on projects in water sports. And then I started my company in Mauritius. So I was into water sports tourism. You know, we were running a guest house. I was renting different water sport gear. So it was all related to water sports. But now, yeah, with those free tours, obviously this is more than full time for me. And I don't really have much time to do anything else. I run, yeah, I'm travel about 6 months a year to events to be there. And the other 6 months, I try to also be at home, see my family, obviously, and get on the water myself, because I'm still also very passionate and active when it comes. I think this is important too. You know, if you don't practice these sports yourself, then you will lose the passion for it. And you don't exactly. You see it strictly as a business. I think this is important also for all our people that work within our team. They are all passionate people about these sports and do these sports themselves. And this was actually one none of them is doing this this only the money, you know, and say, okay, I'm a photographer because I just want to make business. Like even our photographers, videographers, they are sports people themselves, maybe not doing all the discipline. Maybe the one is a kite surfer, one is a wing foiler, one is a foiler or a surfer. But all of them are into these sports and understand them. And yeah, that's amazing. I think that's what I like about also working in this business, that you are dealing with people. Maybe a lot of things are sometimes not as professional as in other businesses, but you're working with
people. It's a community.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really, it's, you hear that all the time, but it's really a community. People are there for each other, help each other out, which is super important. Listen, just if you see me wobbling around, two podcasts ago, we recorded with Balt Smulet on balance boards, and I'm just incorporating that. I'm doing everything on the balance board now. So that's really? Just because I wobble. But let me just ask you, we're going to get into these different world tours, but just this Scion project. So you said that you rent out gear, you have a guest house. How did that start, and why Mauritius? Was that just luck and you threw a dart on a map, or how did that?
No, that came also naturally, I would say. Well, I went to Mauritius the first time in 2002 to study. I did, as I said, I studied international business management in Austria. I had to do one semester abroad. And I didn't want to go anywhere, you know, where these Erasmus exchange programs work, somewhere in Oslo or Stockholm or Paris. I wanted to go somewhere where I could windsurf. At that time, I was really, it was just a step to get onto professional level and get on the world tour. So I was thinking, okay, I'm going to organize it myself, and I want to go somewhere where I can really get in the water a lot. And a friend of mine has been in Mauritius the year before. I didn't know anything about this place, to be honest. And he said, "Ah, it's really good conditions. You have amazing waves. It's wind and so on." It was really unknown at that time, I have to say. It was kind of a secret spot. So I applied at the university there just to see if I could have a chance to get there. And they, yeah, well, they accepted me. So I went there for half a year, not knowing anything about this place. And there were, it was funny because at that time, the rumors about Mauritius were like, ah, you know, it's really heavy localism. It's full of sharks. There is not much wind. And when I arrived there, and after a couple of weeks, I was like, guys, this is paradise. This is here. It's windy every day. It's like perfect waves every day. It's clear water. I don't know what you're all talking about. And they were like, yeah, but don't tell this to anybody. You know, it was still really. Yeah, it was still very sick. There was maybe, you know, a couple cars on the beach, completely different to now.
And how did it change over time?
Yeah, it changed very quick. And then from that time on, so I spent 6 months there. I came back every year for like 2-3 months because the year after I was there studying, I basically turned pro and windsurfing, got an international contract with Nash. And I started to really like get there for training and photo shoots. And yeah, and then I mean, it's an amazing place for water sports, for all kind of water sports, and it's very easy and accessible. You have direct flights from Europe, so a place like that doesn't stay unknown. So within the next couple of years, it really kicked off. You know, it really they started as a couple of big windsurf centers and kitesurf centers started there. Some big competitions happened there, and they all promoted the place. And I would say the years like 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, it doubled the number every year of people that came there. So I came there for like, I came back like 10 years in a row. And then after 10 years, I was already involved in the organization of the windsurf tour. And I had, you know, at some point I always rented a house. That's actually how I started Scion, to come back to this. I kind of, I rented a house every year for like a couple of months for the season. You know, the season there is like from June to September, October, and always stayed there with friends just to make it cheaper for everybody. You know, I rented a house and then I had friends staying over. Everybody paid like €5 and we were sharing the place. And then somehow this went on and people started calling me up that I didn't even know and said, hey, I heard you're running a hostel in Mauritius and how much are the rooms and can we stay there? I was like, guys, no, I'm not running a hostel there. I'm just like, I have a house there.
Maybe I should.
But maybe if you all think I have that, maybe I should just get something going. So I made a deal with a local guy that had a house that I was renting at that time, which was pretty big. It had like 10 bedrooms. It was directly on the beach, not on the spot, but was directly on the water. So I said, hey, I have this idea. I want to run a guest house and I want to start this business, but we need to modify the house a little bit. And he was willing. So I made a contract with him over a couple of years to rent this house to give him a guarantee. And he made some modifications, built some more bathrooms in it, a parking, a storage for equipment. Yeah, and that's how we started. And that's how I started Scion and said, well, let's start a guest house there. And then in the year after, we were growing and we took on a couple other houses with apartments and we started a rental business for accommodations and then cars. And I had a partner who had a car rental company. And then people came and we were like, yeah, but you should also have equipment because we don't want to bring our gear. So I started importing. I started importing gear and had windsurf gear, surfboards, SUPs. And now I have also wing foil, obviously, and surf foil. Yeah, and that's how I started. I started an import-export company there as well. I started selling gear also to shops and hotels. And yeah, but that's how Scion started in 2015. And it was just growing and getting better and better. But then COVID hit us pretty hard, I have to say.
You know,
COVID in Mauritius, the island was basically closed for nearly 2 years. Like the airport was closed. So we had zero tourists for 2 years and that kind of killed up. The business is still existing, but it's on a smaller scale now. Honestly, Mauritius, it took a few years to recover. I would say the last year, 2024, was the first year since COVID where numbers of tourists are back to what it was before. Okay. Because in 2020, 2021, we had zero tourism. And then 22, maybe 50%, 23, 70, 80%, and 24, now it's back. And now you can really see people coming again in a normal scale. But I'm still running this business, but obviously, I wanted to wait a little bit how the tourism will develop. And in that time, I really focused now on the tours and building that, which my wife is mainly managing the Scion business now. And then I got a son as well in COVID. So that took some time obviously as well, and right now we are slowly building it again, but I can just recommend it. I think for me, you know, to be honest, I came to Mauritius, and as I said, 2002 the first time, and at that time I didn't realize how good the place is because I haven't seen a lot of other places yet. And then when I was turning into professional windsurfing, I really traveled a lot. I've been in Hawaii nearly 10 times, South Africa, Australia, all the good places that windsurfing took me. And after 10 years, I kind of realized when I've seen all those places that Mauritius is the best place I know for what I'm looking for. Let's say doing water sports with waves and wind. Mm-hmm. So I like windsurfing in waves. I like kitesurfing in waves. I like wing foiling in waves. I am really into surf foiling. I'll do tow-in. We don't do that much pump foil, obviously, because we have waves. But also, if there's no waves, we do pumping. And now it starts also starting our community to get into downwinding. You know, now lately, a lot of people start using these para wings for downwinding. And that's the next thing that's now happening in Mauritius. So it's an amazing place for all these sports, but it's very easy to reach from Europe, you know, and it's very, and it works all year round. It's a place that really, of course, there is a better season than the worst season, but I would say you can get there all year round. If you really want to get the best wave and wind conditions, you need to go there between May, June, and October, November. But even now, I mean, before I left here now to Sri Lanka, it's been windy nearly every day. Now it's less waves, But for surf foiling, you can still do that nearly every day.
That is
awesome. Well, if I look at a map of Mauritius, where is your guest house?
We are located in the southwest, in the area of Le Morne. You might see Le Morne. That's the southwest tip of the island, which is,
yeah,
let's say,
the most resource.
Exactly. That's the best spot with the strongest wind, the best wave conditions. And we are in the next village from Le Morne, because in Le Morne you have only hotels on the peninsula, but the next village is La Golette, and that's where I'm living. And but I'm not running this guest house anymore. So we have closed it in COVID. We are still working with accommodations, apartments, and so on, but the guest house we're not operating anymore.
That is super. How do you manage? Beautiful, really.
Yeah, it's a lovely place. And how do you manage to, still surf and wing foil and do some world sports when you're running this business and also organizing all these events? How do you balance all this? And plus, you have a family.
Yeah, I'm busy.
I imagine you cannot surf or wing at these events. That's not possible for you.
Yeah, that's true. So when I'm traveling for the competitions, I'm hardly getting in the water myself. That's true. So when I'm not bringing gear to the events. I mean, occasionally, if we are somewhere in Brazil or in a location where I really feel like I want to get on the water, I can always, borrow gear from somebody. There are so many athletes that have equipment. But when I'm traveling, I really don't get on the water a lot. So I mainly get on the water when I'm at home. And as I said, I'm about 6 months, I would say, Mauritius, 6 months on tour. And in these 6 months, when I'm in Mauritius, I try to be on the water every day, at least for an hour. I that's why I live there. And if I can't make that time to have an hour of a session a day, then there wouldn't be no sense for me living in Mauritius. This is a part of the lifestyle there. I work a lot. Obviously, flexible around it. I work a lot at night too, and. When I'm with the events, obviously sometimes I'm gone for a while, sometimes I'm gone 6, 7, 8 weeks that I don't see my family because we have back-to-back events. And that's, I would say, the only downside I also see in living in Mauritius. I think it's an amazing place, but if you need to travel a lot, it's really far from everywhere. So no matter where you go, it's always at least 15 hours to get anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you're quickly going to go home for the weekend, Most of the time I go to an event, events are 5 days, Tuesday to Sunday, and then straight you go to the next one, and then the next one, and yeah, so I have
how
now
do
actually...
How do your wife and kids cope? Do they come with you sometimes to these events?
No, not yet, because my son has just turned 3, so traveling like these long distances is kind of a nightmare. I'm right now in Sri Lanka, actually on my first holiday since COVID, where I went straight from the boat here to Sri Lanka to meet my family here. They came from Mauritius, and I've took now a month to be here and have a holiday trip with them, and then I will go straight to the US from here for the next event in 2 weeks. So
Pensacola, or was it?
Yeah. Pensacola, yeah. The foiling week. Yeah, Pensacola foiling week is the next one happening on the 26th of.
Maybe we can transition into these events. And my first question is, when you change from the windsurf or the organization of the windsurf tour to kiting, usually windsurfers and kiters, they don't like each other too much. How was that for you when you kind of switched sides, or was that not an issue for you and you guys, the pros? Maybe it's for the pros, it's not as similar as for freestyle or just people riding at a spot. How's that for you?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I've been very open to any kind of water sport since the beginning. I mean, windsurfing is my background, where everything started. But I had the first kite in my hand in, I think, 1999, when the first two-line kites came up, Vipika. And honestly, at that time, I was like, I saw these kites, I just windsurfed 4 or 5 years at that time, and not that much, because I was, I was living in Vienna, so I wasn't like in Mauritius being on the water every day. So the first years I windsurfed maybe 2 weeks a year. And then I had this first time a kite in my hand. And I mean, in 1999, maybe you remember that yourself. I mean, these things were just not working. You know, they were
death machine.
You know, you couldn't depower. People were flying into trees all the time, hurting themselves. It was really dangerous at that time, kite surfing. And when I was seeing that, I was like, this sport has no future. I don't think I need to actually, you know, pursue that even further. But I was wrong. I was pretty wrong. A few years later, that sport was booming like crazy. But I always been kiting a little bit since the beginning, you know, and then I didn't want to shift my focus from windsurfing into another sport. I was really like at the time, I wanted to improve my windsurfing skills so much that I kited a bit for fun, but I never really spent too much time on it. So I was always like doing kind of both. And then after some years for me, when I, you know, then I was in Mauritius and I saw these first kites showing up in Mauritius, because when I came to the first time, it was mainly windsurfers. And they were in one eye on those big waves on 20 boards, just going straight lines. I was like, I don't know what these guys are doing. What should that be? But then a few years later, suddenly kiters started to ride on surfboards and they were surfing the wave like surfers and small kites. And I was like, well, okay, that actually looks cool. So I got kite gear again and started again kiting. But as I said, never like too much, but I always did it since the beginning. So I was always really open. I never had a problem with kiters. I never hated kiters. I like kiting a lot. I would say I do it as much as I windsurf. But there are definitely a lot of people out there that don't like each other. This is true. There are kiters that don't like windsurfers and the other way around. And you know, yeah. Obviously, there are a lot of old school windsurfers that have been windsurfing forever, and then kiting came, and I think they were just not ready to switch or open up to it. And then I think there's also a lot of kiters who don't like windsurfers, although they don't understand windsurfing, you know. So it's kind of they don't really have an understanding to have a clear opinion about it, I think. But when I switched from the windsurf tour to the kite tour, there was no issue really. You know, I mean, I've been kiting enough and a lot to understand the sport well enough. I mean, I was never judging kite surfing. For this, we have other experts. But when running a water sports tour, if it's a windsurf tour, a kite surf tour, a wingfoil tour, it's a very similar concept. So there is not really a difference where I think at that time, you know, it was all a little bit disorganized in kite surfing, you know, different tours happening. So I think it was good. I had already 10 years of experience of managing a windsurf tour to bring that into kite surfing and, you know, help grow it and get it more organized and working with a team. But and I don't think athletes had any problem with that, with my background. I think that they actually appreciated the experience that I brought with managing a tour into this. But there was a few people also from my windsurf friends or windsurf group that were like, man, now you're managing the kite tour. Why are you doing this? You know, and why are you switching to the other side? And I said, like,
but the better the people are usually, the more they understand that they do everything anyway already. We can get into that GWA now, the winging, because you said kiting looked kind of stupid at the beginning. I would say it's the same thing with winging. The first wingers, we had to get used to the image of those butterflies being on the water. And now you have the GWA, and it's kind of, you have these four different events, like the Youth World Cup, the World Cup, Continental National events. How is that organized? What's your actual part in these things?
Just to answer your first question quick, I had the same, you know, what you're talking about. When I saw the first wing foil, I was like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. You know, when I saw the first wing foiler, I don't know, 2018, and you know, in the 90s, there have been already wings around. Maybe you remember that. There was already wings without foils that were mounted on a windsurf board. And there was it was called, I don't know, wind, I don't know. Wing or something like this.
I didn't understand that.
It was a mast, but yeah, you needed 30, 35 knots for the thing to ride. You know, there was a few people doing this, but there were already wings around. So when I saw in 2018, the first wing foil prototype, let's say, cruising around, I was like, ah, man, now they are bringing back this wing thing from the 90s and trying to bring this back to life on a foil. Looks weird. You know, they were slow. They were, I don't know. I didn't really like got too hooked too much. Then a year later, I tried it myself the first time with the gear of a friend, because in 2019 was pretty much the first year when the first production gear was available to buy in a shop. There was a few brands like Nash, Duotone, Ozone that came up with wings. Foils were already existing at that time. And I tried the gear of a friend of mine, which was too small and it didn't work at all. And I was like, this doesn't work. But then COVID came and I kind of got into this with the right gear, you know, and we didn't have a lot of gear. We were like building SUP boards in Mauritius because we couldn't get gear. We built foil boxes into 9-foot SUP boards to mount the foil on it. And everybody brought, like, we had a wing. A friend of mine had a wing, so he brought it to the beach. So then we all like put this equipment together and we started playing around with it. Then it got really fun and I got really hooked it and understood it. So just to come back to this question, how I saw wing foiling in the beginning, I had exactly the same. But when I realized how quick and easy this is to learn, I was like, wow, this sport gonna explode, because this is the next thing that can really work everywhere. And my role in the events as a tour manager is that I'm basically, when people ask me that, I would say I'm the one who makes sure that everybody else in the team has the right sets and the right working space and the right environment to do their job. So I kind of overlook everything. I'm talking to the event organizers. I'm, you know, also making contracts together with our CEO, Jürgen. We kind of share this depending, you know, I have obviously quite a network of people that organize events through the past 20 years on the different water sport tours. And a lot of these events where I've been doing organizing windsurf competitions before, I now have switched to kite or wing foil, and maybe also starting now SFT, want to get SFT events going. So this is one part of finding events and signing them up, bringing them on tour, and then also, choosing the team, making sure they do their job right. Obviously, you need to have knowledge in all the parts, be it the sports part, and it's important to have technical knowledge about the sports. I'm not judging, I'm not scoring the heats myself. These are other people who do it. But also the media side. So we need to make sure that everything is branded the right way, that the communication plan is executed the right way. I mean, we have a big team. We are depending if we have live stream and what size of media products we distribute at events. But we are between 15 and 25 people, crew, that go to an event for a kite or wing foil world tour to run this event. So that's not a small group anymore. You know, in the beginning of the windsurf tour, when we organized it, we were going with 3-4 people that were doing all the jobs together.
A lot of meetings, but also expensive, I imagine.
Yeah. This is one of the issues nowadays that obviously because of the standard that is expected and the standard we are running, and that is mainly, I would say, a lot of cost goes into the media side, because now everybody wants to see live streaming, everybody wants to have a TV distribution, everybody wants to have live scoring, social media. So to fulfill these standards, you need quite a few people. You know, we have a copywriter, a social media manager, a media coordinator, a photographer, a 2-3 people media team that is video production, video and editing. I mean, most of the events, you see a new move and 20 minutes later, that thing is online on a reel on social media. As I said, that was 20 years ago a bit more simple. Now, to maintain these standards, you need a big team. On the SFT side, we are keeping it at the moment a little bit more basic, depending on what the organizer needs. You know, so we don't want at the moment, because these sports are smaller. Obviously, if there's an organizer who wants to have the full product, the full level of media output, we do it the same way, like we would do a wing or kite event. But we also give the chance, if there are organizers who want to do something, to do a nice event that they may be not looking for that level of exposure, that we don't set the standard on our side as high for now. because we also know that these sports at the moment don't have the budgets that easily. I think this will come over the years, but like in the Wingfoil Tour, media is one of the most important parts that we really want to push. In the end, people want to see content, people want to see what people do at the events, they want to watch the best guys. And we also want to provide prize money, obviously, but also here we are starting at the moment at the lower level and we'll step this up over the years. This is the plan. I mean, once there are people getting now, at the moment, there are not that many people yet in this non-windboard foil discipline that are full pros, no, that are doing this for a living. But this will come. I think, you know, now that the foil market is growing, there will be companies starting to sponsor people to be on tour. To pay them to do competitions. And then once you have people who make their life out of it, obviously things get more serious and more important. So this is now the first year where we really want to see, you know, how it grows in and how it's accepted and how events going to evolve. But right now I can just see there is a lot of interest. And also because there are so many different disciplines in the SFT, you have for every destination, for every place where it's happening, you have a suitable product. And, you know, be it more focused on the e-foil or on a pump foil or on downwind SUP foiling, depending on the location, there are many, many possibilities. And obviously, we will also have combined events, you know, where it makes sense, meaning that the GWA has a wingfoil event combined with SFT, which we will do already in Cape Verde in March. I'm really looking forward to this event. So this will be an event which is covering actually going to be a pure wave event in Ponta Preta, one of the best waves in the world, I would say, for wind water sports, but also for surfing, where we're going to have a kite surf. Yeah, this spot is, I mean, there is no better place for the wave discipline, to be honest, to broadcast and showcase than Cape Verde, because it's so close. You know, a lot of wave sports, reef is far out, you cannot broadcast it that easily, but it's like a stadium and you have the athletes on the wave and they hear the guys screaming on the beach while they are riding, and this is unique. And you have the cameras 50 meters away. So we're going to have a kitesurf wave world cup, a wingfoil wave world cup, and a tow-in surfoil World Tour event. So this is all going to happen in the middle of March in Cape Verde, and that is definitely something. And we're going to have everything live streamed, so people can watch it from all around the world. So really looking forward to that.
I'm also very much looking forward to that. Let's talk about the SFT specifically, because as it is new, you have to like get to know the athletes, obviously, but also what works. I imagine, well, we talked about it at the boat. You had this idea how it will work with the buoys, with the course, with the pump foiling. And then you changed it on the last day because you said, yeah, for the finals, we're going to have a longer course. How open are you or how much do you discuss with the athletes themselves? And when would you say this SFT project is a success? Do you have numbers or are you just at the end of every season, you're going to talk and see, well, that worked well, we have to improve that, or you're going to say, well, that didn't work, we're going to drop it?
No, we will, like with the other tours, the communication with the athletes is crucial, absolutely. I mean, those are the guys who make the show, no? And it doesn't matter which tour it is, if it's SST or the Wingfoil Tour or the Kaito, the communication with the athletes is crucial, not only with the athletes, also with organizers. You need to understand, basically, when we make decisions, you know, we involve the athletes, we involve organizers, we involve the industry, and we involve also our own crew members that have also different opinions. And, you know, a media guy might see things different than a judge. So all this input is absolutely crucial, especially in the beginning. And we're not going to do this only at the end of the year. We do this throughout the whole year, trying to keep communication. As I said, we just did one event, but over the next events, we also want to build committees in the different disciplines. So there will be a selected group of people that are going to be voted, you know, by other athletes. That represent a discipline, and that we want to have, because it's really difficult, you know, in wing foiling now on the tour, we have, I don't know, 300 athletes that compete over the different disciplines. You cannot talk with 300 people. That is not, that doesn't work. So we have different committees of each discipline, which are around 4, 5, 6 people that are really also interested to develop the discipline. And we are communicating with them, let's say on a monthly, 2 monthly basis, or usually after or before events, to see how rules should be changed, things should be adapted, how they think about it. And we might change rules on every event if necessary. You know, if something is wrong and we feel it shouldn't be this way, we're not going to wait a year to change it. We're going to change it right away on the next event. I think especially in the beginning, this flexibility is super important and you need to listen to everybody. And obviously, you know, those people who are really deep in each disciplines are those who know best. But you also, yeah, see in usually in these discussions, for sure, you know, riders think in their interest, organizers think in their interest, industry thinks in their interest, they want to sell products. So everybody's pushing in one direction and you need to get all these inputs. But in the end, you need to think what is the best for the sport or for the competitive side of it. You know, I think the reason why we want to do this tour is to bring more attention and events and competition. Attract media and attract attention for these sports and can get sponsors involved, you know, like out of industry sponsors, and make them aware of the sports. And this is our idea, that in the end, we want to grow those sports because we see a lot of potential in it and we really love it. And we really want to also for athletes, hopefully be able to build a stage where they can rely on and which is sustainable. I mean, we're not planning, even if things are not good after year one, that we're going to drop the whole SFT. No, it's never that easy. I mean, it was so much work to start this whole project that definitely if we think after year one this doesn't work, we're not going to stop. I think this is a long-term project and I'm very aware of that. And it takes time. And sometimes you can't change things too quick. And we had a lot of positive feedback, I think, from the board. We will also, the next pump foil event we do will have a different format. It will not be in a pool. It will not be a parallel slalom. It will be more like a border cross where people are going to be dog starting at the same time and then going around the course next to each other. So they can fight more on the course, which is more attractive, I think, as well to watch. And we're also going to implement formats like, that's our plan, like the Foil Surf Race League. I don't know if you heard about them or know the formats they are running in the US, which is an interesting, it's a surf foil format, but it's kind of a mix of a surf foil and a pump foil. It's a surf foil format with taking off on a wave, but in the end it's a race. So you take off on a wave and then you need to pump around buoys. It's a very unique format, and that's going to happen now in Pensacola as well. I'm really looking forward to see that live, because
that is super cool. That is really that's really interesting. There are a bunch of races already existing, like in Cozon there was a big race last year.
Yeah,
are you gonna join them or work with them together, or are you gonna say no, that's a different thing, we're doing our thing, you did your thing, but there could be rivalries as well?
No, we are open to work together with everybody. I mean, this is the goal. I think this is how it needs to work. And we want to, existing events, we want to, you know, get them partnered up. And, you know, I think it's a win-win situation. If you have an event that has similar disciplines and we can count them in the tour, doesn't mean that we need to run that event. You know, if an event in Croissant or in Cocoa Beach in Florida is already happening and it's all organized, it's fine. But I think if we can include that, the same like for, you know, Maui to Molokai downwind races that are happening. But I think bringing them together on the platform can just benefit for, it's just a benefit for everybody because they can get more media attention. They can maybe more riders that want to join. And so we are open to including
riders. Sorry, the amount of riders is a problem too, right? For example, at the boat, and I have to ask you that because when I came back, I was super happy that I was able to participate, even though I was not one of the best ones, let's say. But I was super happy to participate. And then I came back and in these WhatsApp chats, because Switzerland's pretty big in pump foiling, I said, yeah, it was super cool, but it was difficult to get in. And there were a bunch of, especially women, who said, well, I wasn't able to participate. That sucked. Where would you, were you able to get in?
Yeah.
And there were just two women. That needs to be addressed. That needs to be different. First of all, in an event like that, you have a certain amount of people who can join. How are you selecting athletes? What do you say to things like that, where they say, well, a two women final or the whole race, that's not really appropriate? How do you, what do you say to them?
Yeah, no, the boat was a special event in that case, where we had to limit the number of participants, and we didn't open the registration publicly so that people can just sign up on purpose, because we knew that we cannot have 50 people competing. You know, as you've been there, you saw the time was rather limited where we could use the pool. We also wanted to make sure that those people who are actually participating have a fair share of time in the pool. Because if we have 50 competitors or 80 competitors, everybody's going to do it one time in the pool. And, you know, you don't want to travel there just for like jumping in the pool once. So, and in wing foiling, it was even a smaller group, because in wing foiling, we had it even less time, because you need the wind machines on, you need the cable working. So they had even less time, and we limited even to 18 people in the wing foil. And that was the reason why we had to kind of select. And it wasn't easy, I have to say, because it was the first event and there were no results lists yet. So we kind of invited a couple of, let's say, international pros that have obviously some names in foiling already, like Tito Angalea, or, you know, there were also actually a few others that said in the beginning they will come from the US and didn't come. But then we had, for those brands who had already were part of the exhibition, had stands there, obviously they wanted to have some team riders in the event. And then we wanted to have a good group of, let's say, local heroes. So of those people that are around Germany, Switzerland, Austria, that are into the sports. And I spoke to different people, like say a few key figures, like about names, because I also didn't know all of them, and we invited them directly. And that's why I know I got this as well. I got this addressed from a couple of people that said, I didn't have the chance to compete. And I explained that for the reason. In the next events, it's going to be different. So in Pensacola or the next pump foil event in Leucat, for example, it's totally open. The registration is already open. Anybody that wants to compete can compete there. And if we get 100 people, we can compete 100 people compete. So this is only the case in the boat where we had to limit it. But all the other events at the moment, I mean, when it gets to a number where we know we're not going to finish anymore, we need to limit it again. Okay. And especially, okay, in surf foil events, like in Cape Verde, it will also be limited, because if we do a surf foil event, we can do a huge number as well, just because we don't have the conditions all the time. But on a pump foil event or an e-foil event or a wake foil event, we can easily handle 50, 60, 70, 80 people if they want to compete.
That is super cool. So for the next boat, it's going to be the same issue though, because of time.
Yes. Yeah. I assume so. But next year in the boat, it's pretty sure. We had a good debrief with the organizer. I think we're going to be back there next year again at the boat. That's already quite sure. We might even maybe see another indoor as well. Let's see. At another location, but we will probably have to make a cut as well there. And next year we're going to have rankings already from this year, so we're going to probably choose, you know, the top guys that are in the top ranking from 2024. They are qualified then for 2025, plus wild cards, plus maybe some other applications where we're going to choose out of that. But in that kind of cases, we need to limit it. You know, there is no other way to do it,
obviously,
because
obviously just space, you know, and time is limited, obviously.
Yeah.
Just we're almost at an hour. Just something else I want to address, kind of a hard question again, because you obviously, the GWA is a global, they're global events. Are there sometimes political issues or climate issues, because people flying all over the world, well, with the climate crisis and whatnot, is there sometimes, do you think about that as well, that that might be some problem that people are traveling all over the world just to get for 1 week to an event? Or is that not really an issue and that's just how it needs to be?
No, it's something we have discussed, obviously, but it is for a global tour hard to avoid. I mean, it's it is if you want to have events with the best guys all around the world, then they need to travel far often. We have a couple of event organizers actually who are also active when it comes to compensation. Of emissions that are, you know, active in a way that they also use that for their marketing. And we are trying to obviously also choose when it comes to crews not to have people flying from one part of the world to the other, but not only for that reason, also for a cost reason. So if we know we do an event in the US, we'll try not to bring, let's say, the whole crew from Europe and rather work with people from the US and the other way around. You know, if we are running an event in Europe, we are hardly bringing people in from the US. The same is for competitors that I would, at the moment with the SFT, also, I don't see that people, that there's a huge number of people that will travel everywhere. I would say if we run an event now in Pensacola, we're really going to count on the American community versus when we come to Europe, there will be many Europeans competing and people that are from that region. But it is something that we are aware of, and that is we are discussing as well. But it's really hard to avoid this if you run a global tour.
Obviously. Yeah. All right. Carl, I'm actually almost through with my list. Do you have anything else in yours?
Well, you covered pretty much everything, guys. Well, on my side, I wanted to ask you a question earlier when we were talking about Mauritius and whatnot. And my question is, so everything changed so fast there, the sport evolving. How it is with the localism? For example, are there people that are there like since ever and they're like kind of trying to protect the island? Because you said at the beginning they were trying to, but how it is now?
Yeah, it has in the beginning when I came there the first time in 2002. I mean, this has been, let's say, the localism has been even been executed stronger than it is now. You know, it was even in windsurfing or kitesurfing. Like, for example, the local, there was one school, one windsurf school at that time, 2002, that were not even allowed to have it to be open on a Sunday. Because Sunday was the day for the locals, and the school had to be closed so that there are no tourists in the water. But this has changed quite a bit. I mean, especially in the wind sport side, when it came windsurfing, kitesurfing, there are so many more tourists now in the water than locals that this is not happening anymore. I think you will rather have issues maybe with people from certain countries than locals. But when it comes to surfing, it still exists, and it's still there are certain spots like the main surf break in Tamarind Bay, Mauritius, that is still, let's say, regulated with localism. I mean, it doesn't mean you cannot surf there, but it is first of all, the spot doesn't work very often, so when it's working, it's always busy, and it is probably, if you're not from there or you don't know people, and you want to sit all the way up on the peak, you will probably get the chat up and will say, guys, well, you're not from here. Well, sit further down. Or you, if it's busy, you know, you can be lucky and you paddle out there during the week when people are working and that's not busy and you're going to surf there. But I think this is, it's also, you know, kind of healthy in a way, because we don't have crowded spots. I mean, that's the beauty of it. It's not really, it's not a surfing destination like Bali anyways. I would say Mauritius is not a real good destination for beginners, for example. So it's not really a place that is super, super suitable for schools, for surf schools, because it hardly has spots that are easy to learn surfing. So most people that are in Mauritius have an intermediate to higher level surfing. But on the other side, I mean, when it comes to foiling, when there is no, you're not having any struggle with
exactly.
that.
Exactly, because
only on the surfing side, there is still a bit of protection on certain spots. But there is plenty of other spots as well that are not busy and you can surf.
Are you considered a local?
Well, I'm there for nearly 25 years now. I know all of them. Yeah, I know all of them well. I think I still wouldn't consider myself a local, because for me, a local is somebody who is really born there, and I'm not. But that's just the way I see it. But I mean, I don't have a problem. Yeah. Riding any spot I want to. I ride a lot with the local people too. For me, a real local is somebody who was born there, and that's not me. My son is born there, so he's a local.
Would you say that prone foiling has the same issue as normal prone surfing, or you think that there is less localism because the arena, let's call it, is a bit bigger?
Yeah, no, there is no issue with surf foiling because those spots that are, let's say, localized, you cannot prone foil there anyway. I mean, these are shallow reef breaks that are pretty heavy, so you wouldn't consider going out and prone. So all the spots where you actually go surf foiling are, you know, mellower spots that are anyway more for tourists than locals, and a couple of spots that you have for surf foiling. I mean, there are not too many, because one issue in Mauritius is obviously the tides. So you always need to go on high tides. On low tides, it's often too shallow to use a foil. So there is not any issue on small reef, or even in Tamarind Bay, some people are surf foiling. They go in a different part of the wave than people that surf shortboards.
Yeah,
so exactly. You don't interfere.
And just one question before I let you go that I also had from earlier on when we were talking about Mauritius. How is life there besides being a paradise for water sports? Is it easy to live there? Because I've been there and I remember I was like, it's super cool, best place ever, but I'm not sure I would live here. So what would you say to someone who's maybe thinking about moving there, maybe with a business? Or with an online business, or finding a normal job there? How is it?
Yeah, it is. It's not easy. To get a work visa is, they're different. I mean, I don't want to go in detail now how to set up this, but it's not as easy as in most other countries. It's definitely hard to settle. Also for the reason, it's a small island, and the labor market is being protected also for local people. So if you are doing a business or are looking for a job that local people can do, it will be very difficult to get a work permit for that as a foreigner. If you are working online and working remote, this is a lot easier because you're not taking up any jobs for local people. Exactly. You're just bringing money and contributing to the economy. So this is welcome, obviously. But in terms of the lifestyle, yeah, it's island life. So it's, I grew up in the city center of Vienna. You know, I had the first 30 years of my life, I was not even seeing anything green in front of my window. I really lived downtown Vienna. And now I'm living in a small village on an island, which is pretty much the opposite of it. But I like it, you know, I like the lifestyle. I mean, it's definitely not, if you're looking for another nightlife or also cultural life, it is not like living in Europe. I think if you're really into nature, there's a lot other things than water sports you can do. You know, there are nice mountains, there are, a lot of things in nature you can explore. I think for a family, it's a great place. I mean, I love seeing my son growing up there, who, you know, he's on the beach every day. He can, there's so much things he can do and explore. But it's definitely not for everybody. I have also seen quite a lot of people that thought they want to move there. They lived there for 1 year or two and then decided to leave again because they were missing something. So I would say the living standard is not much less than in Europe. I mean, there is hardly anything that in terms of any go to a supermarket, any product you wouldn't find, or, you know, you have really good restaurants. It is fairly affordable, I would say, for an island, because most islands are a little bit more expensive to live as everything is imported. It is definitely not very cheap, but it's also not very expensive compared to other islands. I mean, if you live in Maui or a lot of other islands like Fiji, where I have been, I was surprised how expensive they are with, let's say, the standard of living you have. And I think compared to that, it's good in Mauritius. And it also depends where you live. I think it's definitely, the expat community is not big, but it's growing. With local people, because there are not many expats, it's probably not as easy to get connected, you know, if you know what I mean, if you really live there and make close local friends, this takes a while. That's where I have seen other places in the world where you come in as an expat, where this is easier, I would say, just because more expats are living there. And Mauritius has, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's really, I would say the expert percentage is lower than 5%. So
yeah,
it's still a very small part of it. But it's a good life. I think, it's not a party island. If you want to go somewhere where you want to be able to go out and have a party every night, it's not the right place. But it's also not too quiet. You know, I would say it's usually sunrise at 6, sunset at 6. So you have a 12-hour day and it's pretty much all year round like that. And in the evenings, like especially where we are living down in Limorne, it's rather quiet. If you want to go out in the evening, you need to move a little bit to other towns. So it's tropical island life, but with a good standard of living, you know, I would say.
It looks amazing. And Gael and I, we're going to go pump foiling. Each at their own spot, but it's going to be like 2-3 degrees. So it's quite different to Mauritius, obviously. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for coming on the show. All that's left for me is to say who's the next guest going to be. And the next guest is going to be Titouan Galea from New Caledonia, also an island. He's been a wing foil world champion, waterman. And he's actually living in France at the moment. So we're going to have him on. We didn't talk that much about the GWA, but if you want to listen to that, check out the Foil Life podcast, formerly Wing Life podcast of Luke Moore, which is amazing. He was on our show as well, if you want to listen to that. If you want to see or listen to old episodes of us, you can check out www.uponfoil.com, where we kind of put everything together. But then again, Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show, and enjoy your vacation.
Thank you, guys. No, it's been a pleasure. And, I hope we can maybe see in the future, have a couple other chats about other topics about the tour, and maybe at the end of the year also recap a little bit. It's always a good opportunity, any podcast to make people aware of what's going on. And as long as I think it's an interesting topic. Good luck. I think it's a good project, and I really like how active you are with this, and I hope you can grow also your channel and the listeners of these podcasts with the right people.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. To the listeners, the viewers, see you in the next one. Cheers. Bye.